This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents The Common Good. This is the author, Robert B. Reich. Introduction. I was at the impressionable age of 14 when I heard John F. Kennedy urge us not to ask what America can do for us, but what we can do for America. 7 years later, I took a job as a summer intern in the Senate office of his brother, Robert F. Kennedy. It wasn't a glamorous job, to say the least. I felt lucky when I was asked to run his signature machine. But I told myself that in a very tiny way, I was doing something for the good of the country. That was a half century ago. I wish I could say America is a better place now than it was then. Surely our lives are more convenient. 50 years ago, there were no cash machines or smartphones, and I wrote my first book on a typewriter. As individuals, we're as kind and generous as ever. We volunteer in our communities, donate, and help one another. We pitch in during natural disasters and emergencies. We come to the aid of individuals in need. We're a more inclusive society in that African Americans, women, and gays have legal rights they didn't have a half century ago. Yet our civic life, as citizens in our democracy, participants in our economy, managers or employees of companies, and members or leaders of organizations, seems to have sharply deteriorated. What we've lost, I think, is a sense of our connectedness to each other and to our ideals, the America that John F. Kennedy asked that we contribute to. Starting in the late 1970s, Americans began talking less about the common good and more about self-aggrandizement. The shift is the hallmark of our era, from the greatest generation to the me generation, from we're all in it together to you're on your own. In 1977, motivational speaker Robert Ringer wrote a book that reached the top of the New York Times bestseller list entitled Looking Out for Number One. It extolled the virtues of selfishness to a wide and enthusiastic audience. The 1987 film Wall Street epitomized the new ethos in the character Gordon Gekko and his signature line, "Greed, for lack of a better word, is good." The past 5 decades have also been marked by growing cynicism and distrust toward all of the basic institutions of American society, government, the media, corporations, big banks, police, universities, charities, religious institutions, the professions. There's a wide and pervasive sense that the system as a whole is no longer working as it should. A growing number of Americans feel neglected and powerless. Some are poor or black or Latino. Others are white and have been on a downward economic escalator for years. Many in the middle also feel stressed and voiceless. Whether we call ourselves Democrats or Republicans, liberals or conservatives, we share many of the same anxieties and feel much of the same distrust. We've nonetheless been cleaved into warring ideological tribes and tribes within those tribes. Some of us have even been seduced by demagogues and conspiracy theorists. We seem to be a long way from when John F. Kennedy asked that Americans contribute to the well-being of all. We no longer even discuss what we owe one another as members of the same society. As I say this, I'm now a septuagenarian, and Donald Trump is president. In many ways, Trump epitomizes what has gone wrong, but as I hope to make clear, Trump is not the cause. He's a consequence, the logical outcome of what has unfolded over many years. His election was itself propelled by widespread anxieties and distrust toward our political and economic system. Say what you want about him, Trump has at least brought us back to first principles. Some presidents, like Ronald Reagan, got us talking about the size and role of government. Trump has got us talking about democracy versus tyranny. Some presidents, like Bill Clinton, invited a discussion of how we can make the most of ourselves. Trump, by dint of his pugnacious character, and the divisiveness he's fueled raises the question of what connects us, of what we hold in common. Hence, this book. Is there a common good that still binds us together as Americans? That it's even necessary to ask shows how far we've strayed. Today, some think we're connected by the whiteness of our skin, or our adherence to Christianity, or the fact that we were born in the United States. I believe we're bound together by the ideals and principles we share, and the mutual obligations those principles entail. My hope is that this book provokes a discussion of the good we've had in common, what has happened to it, and what we might do to restore it. Perhaps this book can even provide a means for people with opposing views to debate these questions civilly. My goal is not that we all agree on the common good. It's that we get into the habit and practice of thinking and talking about it, and hearing one another's views about it. This alone would be an advance. I should clarify from the start what this book is not. It's not about communism or socialism, although in this fractious era, I wouldn't be surprised if the word common in the title causes some people to assume it is. It's not a book about what progressives or Democrats or Republicans ought to do to win elections, what messages they should convey or policies they should propose. There's already quite enough advice to go around. And it's not a book about Donald Trump, although he does come up from time to time. It's a book about what we owe one another as members of the same society, or at least what we did owe one another more than a half century ago when I heard John F. Kennedy's challenge. It's about the good we once had in common. And if we're to get back to being a far better functioning society, must have again. Part 1. What is the common good? Chapter 1, Shkreli. Begin with Martin Shkreli. Pale, thin, and boyish, with dark hair and an impish grin, Shkreli in early life exemplified the rags-to-riches American success story. He was born in Brooklyn, New York, in March 1983, to parents who emigrated from Albania and worked as janitors in New York apartment buildings. Shkreli attended New York's Hunter College High School, a public school for intellectually gifted young people, and in 2004 received a bachelor's degree in business administration from Baruch College. Almost from the start, Shkreli showed a knack for finding unique ways to make lots of money. He started his own hedge fund, betting that the stock prices of certain biotech companies would drop. But then Shkreli's life story became far less admirable. He used financial chat rooms on the internet to savage the companies he bet against, causing their prices to drop and his bets to pay off. As one investor recalled, Shkreli had a really good knowledge of who was faking drug results and who was gaming the system. Another investor remembered he was willing to take a lot of risk and do things other people won't. Soon thereafter, Shkreli gained control of a pharmaceutical company called Retrofin, and then in 2015 he founded and became CEO of another, Turing Pharmaceuticals. Under his direction, Turing spent $55 million for the U.S. rights to sell a drug called Daraprim. Developed in 1953, Daraprim is the only approved treatment for toxoplasmosis, a rare parasitic disease that can cause birth defects in unborn babies and lead to seizures, blindness, and death in cancer patients and people with AIDS. Daraprim is on the World Health Organization's list of essential medicines. Months after he bought the rights, Shkreli raised its price by over 5,000%, from $13.50 a pill to $750. Shkreli was roundly criticized for doing this, but he felt justified. No one wants to say it, no one's proud of it, but this is a capitalist society, a capitalist system, and capitalist rules, he explained. And my investors expect me to maximize profits, not to minimize them or go half or go 70%, but to go 100% of the profit curve. He claimed he wasn't bothered by the public outcry against him and even wished he had raised the price higher, and said he would buy another drug and raise its price, too. The attempt to public shame is interesting because everything we've done is legal. Standard Oil's John D. Rockefeller made no attempt to apologize as long as what he was doing was legal. In February 2016, Shkreli was called before a congressional committee to justify his price increase for Daraprim. He refused to answer any questions, pleading the Fifth Amendment. After the hearing, Shkreli tweeted, "Hard to accept that these imbeciles represent the people in our government." Shkreli was subsequently arrested in connection with an unrelated scheme to defraud his former hedge fund investors by, among other things, sending them fake performance updates after having lost all the fund's money, and then hiding the losses by raiding funds from Retrofin, the first company he headed. According to U.S. Attorney Robert Capers, Shkreli essentially ran his companies like a Ponzi scheme, in which he ensnared investors through a web of lies and deceit. G. Karthik Srinivasan, an assistant U.S. attorney in the Eastern District Court in Brooklyn, said, "Telling lies on top of lies, this is what that man Martin Shkreli did for years." In anticipation of his criminal trial, Shkreli boasted to the New Yorker magazine, "I think they'll return a not guilty verdict in 2 hours. They're going to be jurors who will be fans of mine. I walk down the streets of New York and people shake my hand. They say, I want to be just like you." During his trial in the Federal District Court in Brooklyn, Shkreli strolled into a room filled with reporters and made light of a particular witness, for which the trial judge rebuked him. On his Facebook page, he mocked the prosecutors, and he told news outlets they were a junior varsity team. He retaliated against journalists who criticized him by purchasing internet domains associated with their names and then mocking them on the sites. "I wouldn't call these people journalists," he wrote in an email to Business Insider. "They are the unwitting recipients of liberalism, subsidy from large media and the telecom companies," adding that they were "only a few notches above the white supremacists we hear so much about these days." On August 4, 2017, after a 5-week trial, Shkreli was convicted on 3 of 8 counts of fraud. Afterward, he called the case a witch hunt of epic proportions, and maybe they found 1 or 2 broomsticks. One of the jurors explained that Martin Shkreli is his own worst enemy. He could have just said to everyone, "I lost the money," but his ego didn't allow him to do that, and that's why he's in the position he is. Initially, some of the jurors were concerned about his mental competence, but they concluded that he knew what he was doing. I chose to begin with Martin Shkreli because his story typifies what has gone wrong. On the basis of the public information we have, what can we reasonably conclude about him? He's obviously smart and driven. It also appears that he'll do whatever it takes to win, regardless of the effects of his behavior on anyone else. He believes that the norms that other people live by don't apply to him. His attitude toward the law is that anything he wants to do is okay unless it is clearly illegal. And even if it's illegal, it's okay if he can get away with it. He shows contempt for anyone who gets in his way, whether judges, prosecutors, or members of Congress. He remains unapologetic for what he has done. Presumably, he'd do the same in a heartbeat. In all these ways, Martin Shkreli defies what might be called the common good. But I ask you, how different is Martin Shkreli from other figures who dominate American life today, even at the highest rungs? The idea of the common good was once widely understood and accepted in America. After all, the U.S. Constitution was designed for we the people, seeking to promote the general welfare, not for me the selfish jerk seeking as much wealth and power as possible. During the Great Depression of the 1930s and World War II, Americans faced common perils that required us to work together for the common good. And that good was echoed in Franklin D. Roosevelt's 4 freedoms: freedom of speech, of worship, from want, and from fear. The common good animated many of us, both white and black Americans, to fight for civil rights and voting rights in the 1960s. It inspired America to create the largest and most comprehensive system of public education the world had ever seen. And it moved many of us to act against the injustice of the Vietnam War, and others of us to serve bravely in that besotted conflict. Most people are hardwired for some degree of cooperation with and compassion toward others. Human beings would not have survived on Earth to this point were we entirely selfish. Some people are downright heroic. Consider the first responders to 9/11 and to massive hurricanes. The two bystanders who sought to protect a young Muslim woman from being attacked on a train in Portland, Oregon in the spring of 2017 and paid with their lives. The thousands of police and firefighters who every day put themselves in harm's way for the good of their communities. The hundreds of thousands of men and women in the armed forces who risk their lives for their country. The whistleblowers who risk jobs and careers to report misdeeds in business or government. The owners of companies who remain in their communities and keep people employed despite the lure of higher profits elsewhere. You can also see it in everyday altruism among strangers, helping someone lift a stroller up the stairs to a park, calling for medical assistance, aiding a disabled person. Yet the common good is no longer a fashionable idea. The phrase is rarely uttered today, not even by commencement speakers and politicians. It feels slightly corny and antiquated, if not irrelevant. I doubt Martin Shkreli has the slightest idea of what it is. You find growing evidence of a breakdown. You see it in other CEOs who also gouge their customers, loot their corporations, and defraud investors. In athletes involved in doping scandals. In doctors who do unnecessary procedures to collect fatter fees. In lawyers and accountants who look the other way when corporate clients play fast and loose, who even collude with them to skirt the law. In the Wall Street bankers who defrauded their investors and brought the nation to the brink of economic collapse in 2008 before they were bailed out by taxpayers. You find it in police chiefs who look the other way when their officers violate the legal rights of Latinos or African Americans, sometimes injuring or killing them for no reason. In film producers and publicists who choose not to see that a powerful movie mogul they depend on is sexually harassing young women. In politicians who take donations, really bribes, from wealthy donors and corporations to enact laws their patrons want, or who shutter the government when they don't get the partisan results they seek, and in a president of the United States who lies repeatedly about important issues, refuses to put his financial holdings into a blind trust, and then personally profits off his office and foments racial and ethnic conflict. The deterioration I'm referring to is sometimes the handiwork of likable men and women who appear to be good-willed and generous, but who in reality have no concern for anything beyond their own driving ambition. They, too, will do whatever it takes to win. One day in the spring of 2016, on a corner near my home in Berkeley, where I was waiting for the traffic light to change, I began a conversation with a well-dressed man who was also waiting to cross the street. He introduced himself as John Stumpf. His suit and tie seemed so out of place in Berkeley that I asked him what he did for a living. He explained he was CEO of Wells Fargo Bank and was on his way to a meeting. I mentioned that I had been in the Clinton administration and was not a fan of the Wall Street bailout. We decided to continue our conversation and arranged to have a coffee together the following week. I found Stumpf to be charming and self-effacing. He asked me how I thought Wells Fargo could do a better job letting the public know it wasn't one of those big, bad Wall Street banks, and was making a major effort to be responsible and responsive to its customers and the communities it served. I offered a few ideas, worth no more than the coffee he treated me to. Afterward, I remember thinking how fortunate it was for Wells Fargo to be led by such an admirable person. A few months later, after news reports of widespread consumer fraud, Wells Fargo admitted to putting millions of its customers' deposits into credit card and bank accounts that the customers had never requested, plunging a number of them into default. As a result of their damaged credit ratings, these customers had to pay an extra $50 million to borrow money. The bank also acknowledged it had charged another 500,000 customers for auto insurance they neither needed nor sought, pushing more than 250,000 of them into delinquency on their car and insurance payments and leading to nearly 25,000 wrongful vehicle repossessions. The bank had also enrolled thousands of customers in online bill pay services they never wanted, charging them nearly $1 million in fees. As if this were not enough, the bank then argued in federal court that its bilked customers had no right to sue the bank as a group, but had to rely on individual arbitration that would likely cost them more in legal fees than any damage reward they might receive. Before all of this came to light, the bank's top executives, led by Stumpf, ignored the accumulating evidence of fraud. The bank's profits were soaring. It became the fourth most profitable U.S. corporation in 2016. In calls with Wall Street investment analysts, Stumpf repeatedly touted Wells Fargo's ability to sell more and more products to customers. While the frauds were occurring, the value of Stumpf's own stock holdings rose about $200 million. Stumpf was not, it turned out, someone who was concerned about his customers and communities. In many respects, Stumpf was just a more charming version of Martin Shkreli. He was another who had chosen to enrich himself whatever it took, whatever the consequences, the common good be damned. Chapter 2. What good do we have in common? The common good consists of our shared values about what we owe one another as citizens who are bound together in the same society, the norms we voluntarily abide by, and the ideals we seek to achieve. It is a way of thinking quite opposite to that of Martin Shkreli, John Stumpf, and several other of today's more notorious business and political leaders. A concern for the common good, keeping the common good in mind, is a moral attitude. It recognizes that we're all in it together. If there is no common good, there is no society. Some thinkers and philosophers have attacked the idea of a common good. They argue it's too easily hijacked by dictators and demagogues who want to use it to justify their tyranny and to squelch individual freedom.
"The common good is an undefined and undefinable concept," wrote Ayn Rand. "A moral blank check for those who attempt to embody it."
When the common good of a society is regarded as something apart from and superior to the individual good of its members, she wrote,
"it means that the good of some men takes precedence over the good of others, with those others consigned to the status of sacrificial animals."
Rand was a Russian emigre to the United States whose father's business had been confiscated during the Russian Revolution. Her most influential writing occurred in the 1940s and 1950s, in the shadow of European fascism and Soviet communism. She was best known for two highly popular novels that are still widely read today, The Fountainhead, 1943, and Atlas Shrugged, 1957, and for other writings and interviews in which she expounded her views about what she called the virtue of selfishness. Rand saw government actions that require people to give their money and resources to other people under the pretext of a common good as steps toward tyranny. She believed that man exists for his own sake, that the pursuit of his own happiness is his highest moral purpose, that he must not sacrifice himself to others, nor sacrifice others to himself, as she said in a 1964 interview. Medicare, for example, might be desirable for the elderly, she argued, but when others are forced to pay for it, they are on ground that could as easily justify
the enslavement and therefore the destruction of medical science, the regimentation and disintegration of all medical practice, and the sacrifice of the professional integrity, the freedom, the careers, the ambitions, the achievements, the happiness, the lives of the very men who are to provide that desirable goal, the doctors.
It was far better, in Rand's view, to base society on autonomous, self-seeking, and self-absorbed individuals. To her, the only community that any of us has in common are family and friends, maintained voluntarily. If we want to be generous, she thought, that's fine, but no one should have the power to coerce us into generosity. And nothing beyond our circle of voluntary associations merits our trust. No institutions or organizations should be able to demand commitments from us. All that can be expected or justified from anyone is selfish behavior, she thought. That behavior is expressed most clearly through the acts of selling what we have to sell and buying what we want to buy in a free market. For her, the common good did not exist. Rand's philosophy was updated and formalized in 1974 by Harvard philosopher Robert Nozick in his best-selling book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. Nozick argued that individual rights are the only justifiable foundation for a society. Instead of a common good, he wrote, there are only individual people, different individual people, with their own individual lives. For Nozick, it logically followed that using one of these people for the benefit of others uses him and benefits the others, nothing more. Talk of an overall social good covers this up. When Rand and Nozick propounded these ideas, they seemed quaint, if not far-fetched. Anyone who lived through the prior half-century had witnessed our interdependence through depression and war. After the war, we'd used our seemingly boundless prosperity to finance all sorts of public goods, schools and universities, a national highway system, and health care for the aged and poor, Medicare and Medicaid. We rebuilt war-torn Europe. We sought to guarantee the civil rights and voting rights of African Americans. We opened doors of opportunity to women. Of course, there was a common good. We were living it. But then, starting in the late 1970s, Rand's views gained ground. She became the intellectual godmother of modern-day American conservatism, especially its libertarian strand. President Donald Trump has said Rand is his favorite writer, and that he identifies with Howard Roark, the protagonist of The Fountainhead, an architect who dynamites a housing project he designed because the builders did not precisely follow his blueprints. Trump's Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, called Atlas Shrugged his favorite book. Trump's CIA chief, Mike Pompeo, cited Rand as a major inspiration. Before he withdrew his nomination to be Trump's Secretary of Labor, Andrew Puzder said he devoted much of his free time to reading Rand. The Republican leader of the House of Representatives, Paul Ryan, required his staff to read Rand. Rand fans are also found at some of the high reaches of American business. Uber's founder and former CEO, Travis Kalanick, has also described himself as a Rand follower. He applied many of her ideas to Uber's code of values. Kalanick even used the Fountainhead's original cover art as his Twitter avatar. I believe Rand, Nozick, and their more modern incarnations are dangerously wrong. Not only does the common good exist, but it is essential for a society to function. Without voluntary adherence to a set of common notions about right and wrong, daily life would be insufferable. We'd be living in a jungle where only the strongest, cleverest, and most wary could hope to survive. This would not be a society. It wouldn't even be a civilization, because there would be no civility at its core. Americans sharply disagree about exactly what we want for America or for the world. But we must agree on basic principles, such as how we deal with our disagreements, the importance of our democratic institutions, our obligations toward the law, and our respect for the truth, if we're to participate in the same society. It's our agreement to these principles that connects us, not agreement about where these principles lead. Edmund Burke, the 18th century British statesman and political thinker, who was the philosophical founder of modern conservatism, saw the common good as the general bank and capital of nations. and of ages. It is the source of civic virtue. To take the most basic example, we depend on people's widespread and voluntary willingness to abide by laws, not just the literal letter of laws, but also the spirit and intent behind them. Consider what would happen if no one voluntarily obeyed the law without first calculating what they could gain by violating it, as compared with the odds of the violation being discovered multiplied by the size of the likely penalty. We'd be living in bedlam. If everyone behaved like Martin Shkreli, much of our time and attention would have to be devoted to outwitting or protecting ourselves from others. We would have to assume everyone else was out to exploit us, if they could. Every interaction would need to be carefully hedged. Penalties would need to rise, and police enforcement to increase, in order to prevent the Shkrelis among us from calculating they might have more to gain by violating the law and risking the penalty than by abiding it. And because laws can't possibly predict and prevent every potential wrong, they'd have to become ever more detailed and exacting in order to prevent the Shkrelis from circumventing them. Even then, we'd be in trouble. We couldn't rely on legislators to block or close loopholes because the Shkrelis would bribe legislators to keep them open, and Shkreli legislators would certainly be open to taking such bribes. Even if we managed to close the loopholes, we couldn't rely on police to enforce the laws because the Shkrelis would bribe the police not to, and Shkreli police would also accept the bribes. Without a shared sense of responsibility to the common good, we would have to assume that everybody, including legislators, judges, regulators, and police, was acting selfishly, making and enforcing laws for their own benefit. I know it's hard to imagine, but even a president of the United States could act like Shkreli. The followers of Ayn Rand, who glorify the free market and denigrate government, are fooling themselves if they think the free market gets them off this Shkreli hook. The market is itself a human creation, a set of laws and rules that define what can be owned and traded and how. Government doesn't intrude on the free market. It creates the market. Government officials, legislators, administrators, regulators, judges, and heads of state must decide on and enforce such laws and rules in order for a market to exist. Without norms for the common good, officials have no way to make these decisions other than their own selfish interests. Over the years, public officials have decided that you cannot own human beings, nuclear bombs, recipes, or the human genome. You're not permitted to buy sex, babies, or votes. You can't sell dangerous drugs, unsafe foods, or deceptive Ponzi schemes. You mustn't force other people to sell or buy anything from you. By the same token, you have to pay your debts, unless you're allowed to reorganize them under bankruptcy. Even then, you're allowed to use bankruptcy only under certain conditions. Other market rules cover everything from what can be copyrighted or patented to whether contracts can require arbitration of disputes, whether specific proposed mergers and acquisitions create too much market power, and whether employment contracts can prevent employees from working for a competitor. Hopefully, government officials base these sorts of decisions on their notions about the common good. But if Shkrelis were making and enforcing such rules, they'd be based on whatever it took for these Shkreli officials to gain personal wealth and power. The free market would be a sham, and most people would lose out in it. As you'll hear, something close to this has in fact occurred. Truth itself is a common good. Through history, one of the first things tyrants have done is attack independent truth-tellers. Philosophers, Plato. Scientists, Galileo. And the free and independent press, thereby confusing the public and substituting their own facts. Without a shared truth, democratic deliberation is hobbled. Alternative facts are an open invitation to what George Orwell described as doublethink, in which the public is so confused it cannot recall the past, assess the present, or contemplate the future. As poet and philosopher Václav Havel put it, if the main pillar of the system is living a lie, then it is not surprising that the fundamental threat to it is living in truth. Yet in a world populated by people like Martin Shkreli, we couldn't trust anyone to be truthful if they could do better for themselves by lying. We couldn't count on any claim by sellers of any product or service. Internet-based reputational ratings would be of little value because Shkreli raters would be easily bribed. Transparency would be impossible because Shkrelis would hide the truth and mess with all indicators of it. Journalists would shade their reports for their own selfish advantage, taking bribes from advertisers or currying favor with politicians. Teachers would offer lessons to satisfy wealthy or powerful patrons. Historians would alter history if by doing so they gained wealth or power. Scientists would doctor evidence for similar selfish motives. The truth would degenerate into a cacophony of competing factual claims. We couldn't trust doctors or pharmacists to give us the right medications. We couldn't trust bankers and accountants not to fleece us, restaurants not to poison us, lawyers not to hoodwink us. All ratings would be gamed. Professional ethics would be meaningless. If we couldn't believe anything we heard, we would find ourselves in a permanent state of bewilderment. As Augustine said, nothing at all of human society remains safe if we shall determine to believe nothing which we cannot grasp by full apprehension. The common good is especially imperiled when a president of the United States alleges that millions of unauthorized immigrants voted illegally, when there's no evidence they did, that the news media cover up terrorism by Islamic extremists, when nothing suggests they do, that his predecessor in office illegally wiretapped him, when no facts back up such a claim, and that his journalistic critics peddle fake news without evidence of such duplicity. Such baseless claims mislead and confuse the public. They erode trust. They fuel conspiracy theories. They can lead to a vicious cycle in which opportunists use the prevailing distrust to propagate more lies for their own purposes. Alex Jones, best known for suggesting 9/11 was an inside job and the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting was completely fake, has said, "The public doesn't have any trust in the system. They believe the social contract is broken," which is exactly what has enabled people like Jones to gain influence. Most basically, the common good depends on people trusting that most others in society will also adhere to the common good, rather than lie or otherwise take advantage of them. In this way, civic trust is self-enforcing and self-perpetuating. As James Madison put it when advocating the Bill of Rights, the mere knowledge of its existence would, quote, "extinguish from the bosom of every member of the community any apprehensions that there are those among his countrymen who wish to deprive them of the liberty for which they valiantly fought and honorably bled," end quote. History has shown that the more commitment to the common good there is within a society, the more willing are its inhabitants to accept disruptions that inevitably accompany new ideas, technologies, opportunities, trade, and immigration. That's because these inhabitants are more likely to trust that the disruptions won't unfairly burden them, and that they stand to gain more than lose by them. This sort of virtuous circle is more likely in societies that promote political equality and equal opportunity, because people who have an equal voice in setting the rules and an equal chance to get ahead naturally feel more assured that their concerns will be addressed and that changes can work to their advantage. But when that trust is undermined or was never there to begin with, disruptive change can generate widespread anger and fear, and even political upheaval. Under these circumstances, virtuous circles can reverse themselves and become vicious cycles. If those who feel left behind view the system as rigged against them, they can push open societies into becoming closed and autocratic. Where a sense of common good is lacking, demagogues can use the anger and fear accompanying disruptive change to turn people against one another, rather than address the traumas that made them angry in the first place. Societies experiencing economic stresses and widening inequalities are particularly vulnerable to tyrants intent on undermining democratic institutions by lying repeatedly, accusing critics of conspiring against the people, fueling racial and ethnic divisions, and inciting rabid nationalism. Polls tell us that a majority of today's Americans worry that the nation is losing its national identity. The core of that identity has never been "we're better than anyone else" nationalism, nor has it been the whiteness of our skin or the uniformity of our ethnicity. Our core identity, the most precious legacy we've been given by the generations who came before us, is the ideals we share, the good we hold in common. If we are losing our national identity, it's not because we're becoming browner or speak in more languages than we once did. It's because we are losing our sense of the common good. "We're better than anyone else" nationalism, tinged with racism, typically emerges in countries where demagogues build their base of power by fueling fears of others outside the nation's borders. The assertion made in 2017 by Marine Le Pen, leader of France's National Front, that the major political contest in today's world is between globalism and patriotism, was nothing but fear-based nativism. So was Donald Trump's America First rallying cry in the 2016 presidential election, which echoed earlier nativist calls in America in the 1850s, 1890s, and 1920s, for the nation to shut itself off from the rest of the world. In contrast to John F. Kennedy's call to put selfishness aside and invest more of ourselves in the common good, Trump called on Americans to prevent the rest of the world from encroaching on us. "We will not allow other countries to take advantage of us like they've been doing to a level that's hard to believe," he said in his surly inauguration speech. "Nobody, nobody can beat us. Nobody. We're Americans, and the future belongs to us." Early in his administration, Trump's foreign policy team flatly rejected the idea that the world is a global community, in favor of the zero-sum fallacy that the world is an arena where nations, non-governmental actors, and businesses engage and compete for advantage. But we're not in a zero-sum game with the rest of the world. Our common good is inextricably bound up in the good of the rest of the planet. America understood this explicitly in the decades after World War II, when we helped rebuild war-torn Europe and Japan. To be sure, at least since the end of World War II, America has sought to be the world's leading superpower, but not until Trump, as an administration, viewed other nations' gains as our losses, and vice versa. The common good has nothing whatever to do with the United States being the best. It's not about securing borders, erecting walls, and keeping others out. It is not xenophobic. It doesn't focus on exclusion at all. To the contrary, the common good is about inclusion, joining together to achieve common goals. In fact, it's by coming together for the common good that we gain compassion for others beyond a nation's borders. As Edmund Burke put it, "To be attached to the subdivision, to love the little platoon we belong to in society, is the first principle, the germ, as it were, of public affections. It is the first link in the series by which we proceed toward a love to our country and to mankind." Burke, long a hero to American conservatives, was no nationalist. He devoted most of his career to defending oppressed groups around the world, such as American colonists who were being exploited by his own British compatriots, Irish Catholics who were being discriminated against, and the masses of India. In so doing, Burke did not base his arguments on universal principles of human rights. He based them on moral precepts underlying Britain's own laws and unwritten constitution. "We're better than anyone else," nationalists typically don't know or care about the rest of the world. As George Orwell dryly observed, a nationalist, although endlessly brooding on power, victory, defeat, revenge, is typically uninterested in what happens in the real world. True patriots, by contrast, are deeply curious about and open to the rest of humanity. Their sense of the common good doesn't end at the nation's borders. Daniel Freed, who joined the U.S. Foreign Service in 1977 and served America with distinction for 40 years, said on his retirement in February 2017, "We are not in an ethno-state with identity rooted in shared blood. The option of a white man's republic ended at Appomattox. We have imperfectly, and despite detours and retreats along the way, sought to realize a better world for ourselves and for others. For we understood that our prosperity and our values at home depend on that prosperity and those values being secure as far as possible in a sometimes dark world." America's original sin was not the exclusion of people born outside the nation's borders from citizenship. It was the exclusion of many people who had lived here even before the start of the Republic, in particular, Native Americans and African Americans. For most of its existence, America found it relatively easy to assimilate foreigners, although there were periods of sharp and even violent tension. By the 1840s, every major seaport teemed with inhabitants from around the globe. Fijians, Tonga Tabors, Aromangians, Penangians, and brigands, and other wild specimens of the whaling craft, as Herman Melville described the streets of New Bedford, Massachusetts, in Moby Dick. Until the early 1920s, almost anyone could come to America and become a citizen. Yet from its inception, America refused to include Native Americans and African Americans as equal citizens. In Dred Scott v. Sanford, 1857, a majority of the Supreme Court shamefully held that African Americans could not become the fellow citizens of white Americans because they were, quote, "beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race," end quote. Dred Scott was overruled, but the fight for equal justice in America, for a more inclusive "we the people," has continued. That fight, too, is part of the common good. The poems of Walt Whitman and Langston Hughes and the songs of Woody Guthrie express loving devotion to America while turning that love into a demand for justice. "This land is your land. This land is my land," sang Guthrie. "Let America be America again," pleaded Hughes. "The land that never has been yet and yet must be. The land where every man is free. The land that's mine, the poor man's, Indians, Negroes, me, who made America." Patriotism based on the common good does not pander to divisiveness. True patriots don't fuel racist or religious or ethnic divisions. They aren't homophobic or sexist or racist. To the contrary, true patriots confirm the good that we have in common. They seek to strengthen and celebrate the we in we the people. A love of country based on the common good entails obligations to other people, not to national symbols. Instead of demanding displays of respect for the flag and the anthem, it requires that all of us take on a fair share of the burdens of keeping the nation going, that we pay taxes in full rather than seek tax loopholes or squirrel away money abroad, that we volunteer time and energy to improving the community and country, serve on school boards and city councils, refrain from political contributions that corrupt our politics, and blow the whistle on abuses of power even at the risk of losing our jobs. It has sometimes required the supreme sacrifice. We are the descendants of Nathan Hale, soldier and spy for the Continental Army during the Revolutionary War, who famously declared, just before being executed by the British in 1776, that his only regret was having but one life to lose for my country. Franklin D. Roosevelt, in the midst of the Great Depression of the 1930s, called upon America's wellspring of generosity and sacrifice for the good of all.
"If I read the temper of our people correctly," he said, "we now realize, as we have never realized before, our interdependence on each other, that we cannot merely take, but we must give as well, that if we are to go forward, we must move as a trained and loyal army willing to sacrifice for the good of a common discipline, because without such discipline, no progress is made. No leadership becomes effective. We are, I know, ready and willing to submit our lives and property to such discipline because it makes possible a leadership which aims at a larger good."
This sense of a common good also embraces public education, but not as a personal investment in getting a good job after one's education is complete. Education is a public good that builds the capacity of a nation to wisely govern itself and promotes equal opportunity. Democracy depends on citizens who are able to recognize the truth, analyze and weigh alternatives, and civilly debate their future, just as it depends on citizens who have an equal voice and equal stake in it. Without an educated populace, a common good cannot even be discerned. This is fundamental. When education is viewed as a private investment yielding private returns, there's no reason why anyone other than the investor should pay for it. But when understood as a public good underlying our democracy, all of us have a responsibility to ensure that it is of high quality and available to all. Our central obligation as citizens is to preserve, fortify, and protect our democratic form of government, not inundate it with big money and buy off politicians. We must defend the right to vote and ensure that more citizens are heard, not fewer. We can't hate our government, for it is the means by which we can come together to help solve our common problems. We may not like everything the government does, and we justifiably worry when special interests gain too much power over it. But our obligation is to work to improve government, not undermine it. Although Americans have strong disagreements about the size and scope of government, most of us still believe in our system of government. We're often angry and disappointed at how far it falls short of our ideals, and we can be incensed when the system appears to be rigged against us. But most of us agree with its ideals, and we're angry at the rigors, not at the system. As citizens, we're committed to the Constitution and the rule of law, to democracy based on the consent of the governed. We're committed to the Bill of Rights, to an independent judiciary, separation of powers between the executive, the legislature, and the courts, and in checks and balances among those three branches. We believe in federalism, giving states and localities significant responsibilities. We believe in freedom of speech. We're committed to a free and independent press. Importantly, most of us believe in political equality. We believe that citizens should have an equal right to vote, and that no one's vote should count more than anyone else's. We believe in equality before the law, and that no one should be above the law. We don't want government to discriminate against racial or ethnic minorities. The genius of a system based on political equality is that it doesn't require us to agree on every issue, but only agree to be bound by decisions that emerge from the system. Some of us may want to prohibit abortions because we believe life begins at conception. Others of us believe women should have the right to determine what happens to their bodies. Some of us want stricter environmental protections, others more lenient. We are free to take any particular position on these and any other issues, but as political equals, we are bound to accept the outcomes even if we dislike them. This requires enough social trust for us to regard the views and interests of those with whom we disagree as equally worthy of consideration to our own. As philosopher John Rawls has written, questions of justice and fairness arise when free persons, who have no authority over one another, are participating in their common institutions and among themselves settling or acknowledging the rules which define them and which determine the resulting shares in their benefits and burdens. Ayn Rand had it completely wrong. Moral choices logically involve duties to others, not just calculations about what's best for ourselves. When members of a society ask, what is the right or decent thing to do? They necessarily draw upon understandings of these mutual obligations. While our contemporary culture of self-promotion, iPhones, selfies, and personal branding churns out a fair number of narcissists, it is our loyalties and attachments that define who we are. Chapter 3. The Origins of the Common Good. It is important not to romanticize the past. As I've noted, at America's founding, the common good did not include African Americans or Native Americans. Women and the non-propertied poor could not vote. The founding fathers nonetheless embraced a set of principles that would eventually lead to a far more inclusive society. They understood that the best way to preserve freedom was through people fiercely committed to it. When they spoke of virtue, it was not as we understand the term, involving personal kindness and generosity. For them, virtue meant a concern for the common good. Without a virtuous citizenry, they feared the young republic would succumb to authoritarian rule. They didn't try to create the most efficient system of governance, or one that would generate the most wealth. They wanted a system that would produce the most virtuous people. "Is there no virtue among us?" asked James Madison rhetorically. "If there be not, no form of government can render us secure. To suppose that any form of government will secure liberty or happiness without any virtue in the people is a chimerical idea." In Federalist No. 71, Madison wrote that, "It is a just observation that the people commonly intend the public good." And in Federalist No. 45, he claimed that, "The public good, the real welfare of the great body of the people, is the supreme object to be pursued, and that no form of government whatever has any other value than as it may be fitted for the attainment of this object." Both Madison and Thomas Jefferson were influenced by the 18th century French Enlightenment philosopher Montesquieu, who defined a republic as a self-regulating political society whose mainspring was civic virtue. Edmund Burke likewise noted the connection between a virtuous citizenry and the prevention of tyranny. In his Thoughts on the Cause of the Present Discontents, Burke warned that, quote, "When bad men combine, the good must associate, else they will fall one by one an unpitied sacrifice in a contemptible struggle, end quote. Almost two centuries later, Martin Luther King Jr. applied the same logic to the struggle for civil rights in America.